Hi, this is Cynthia Davis. On today's show, we talk about what America looks like from a fresh perspective. We can all agree that our country seems to be heading the wrong direction, but you're about to hear what you can do to get it back on the right track.
I'm an American!
Welcome to Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, your host, and I'm here to help. From parenting to public policies to political advice, join me in taking America back one family at a time. As a speaker, writer, former legislator, mother of seven, and wife of one for over 30 years, I bring you my experience.
Don't lose your freedom.
And now it's time for Homefront.
Don't lose your freedom. Let's talk about it.
Welcome to Homefront. Today we have Dave Toth. Dave is a missionary. And he's originally from the United States, but he spent a little bit of time most recently in some Eastern European countries. So good afternoon, Dave. Tell us how you're doing.
Well, Cynthia, actually, good afternoon. I am doing great. It's a February cold, snowy day here in Waynesville, but it's good to be with friends and good to talk about, what's going on in our country and culture.
Well, I met you back when you were serving some time here in the St. Louis area at a Christian and Missionary Alliance church, and a lot has happened since then. So I want you to share a little bit about how you started off, how you got to St. Louis, and where you've been since then. So David is a missionary. He has spent some time, it looks like you started in Oregon, then when I met you, you were in St. Louis, and since then you've gone on to change the rest of the world. How did you begin, and what brought you to St. Louis, and what have you been doing ever since?
Well, I went to Toccoa Falls College in Georgia for my undergraduate work, and I went there to prepare for ministry, and I thought it would be pastoral ministry. And so I graduated from there, and then I moved to St. Louis to attend Covenant Theological Seminary. Actually, one of my professors at Toccoa was an alumni of that school, and I had such respect for him, I was greatly influenced by his teaching and ended up in St. Louis to attend Covenant. While there, we did attend Crestwood Alliance Church, and that's where you and I and your dad and family made the connection. And I was there for 4 years. I worked full-time at a bank. I was a data processing operations supervisor, and that's how I was able to make the mortgage payment and feed the family while doing my master's degree. After finishing, we moved to Iowa, and I became the pastor of a church in Iowa. And I was there for 8 years, and things were going well. I enjoyed pastoral ministry. And then I got called to another church in Ohio. It sounded very interesting opportunity. And so we moved from Iowa to Ohio. And then a very short time after moving to Ohio, the district superintendent of the region, of that region for the Christian Missionary Alliance, wanted me to come on board and oversee the church planting ministry. I did that. And for 7 years, I really focused on beginning new congregations. During that time, I I really, my eyes were open because I interacted with different denominations. I interacted with different sociological people groups, and it really enriched my whole worldview as a result. After about 6 years, I attended a conference on church planting. In fact, I was one of the main speakers. And the people who organized the conference, at the end, they asked me if I would go to Budapest, Hungary, to join a church planting team. That caught me completely off guard. At that time, I was like 48 years old. I decided I was too old to make a change. I also decided that God would never call me as a missionary at that age, but I told him I would pray about it, and God convinced me that, in fact, he had other ideas for my life. And so I found myself moving to Budapest, Hungary, and for 8 years, I traveled all over Eastern Europe, primarily focusing on training church planting pastors. Towards the end of that time in Budapest, I began to develop a serious concern about our church planting ministry. The short story is that many churches got off to a good start, but then faltered and never really developed the way that the original vision for the church was established. And as a result, I did a lot of research and found that, unfortunately, though the church was started with a lot of energy and organization and program, there was not a serious in-depth understanding of how to disciple people and develop leaders. As a result, I shifted my focus in that direction, and ever since that time, and that's been now about 14 or 15 years, I have focused on leadership development and discipleship. Moved back to the U.S. I still go to Eastern Europe. I'm working a lot in Ukraine. Just recently, re-engaging in Kazakhstan, small project in Serbia. And I love helping people to make disciples like Jesus made disciples.
So let me ask you this. My sister and brother-in-law are missionaries, and they went to France for a number of years, and it was always so surprising to come back to the United States every 4 years and see all the changes that have happened. Here, when they left, this was the 1980s, they went to Zaire, the Congo, Africa, came back. They expected the Congo to be rough. What they weren't expecting was to see the cultural slide here in the United States. And while we're living here and we've seen the changes happen very slowly, it shocked them to see how fast, when you're only here every 4 years, how quickly we've disintegrated morally. What have you observed?
Yes, I have observed the same thing, Cynthia. My wife, Marion, and I moved to Eastern Europe in 2000, and we moved back to the States in 2008. And in just that 8 years when we moved back, now, of course, we visited in the interim, we visited back to the U.S. once or twice every few years. But when we moved back after 8 years, we genuinely felt as if we were moving to a foreign country in comparison to the one we left. Some of the features of that change, I would say one thing, Christianity became and is still yet becoming more of a nominal thing. Instead of a serious lifestyle commitment, it's now more of a programmatic, organizational part of our social life where some people, increasingly fewer, I might add, but some people go to this building on Sunday morning. And so I see nominal Christianity growing. and serious Christianity that involves a whole lifestyle approach is seriously diminishing.
So my husband and I owned a Christian bookstore here in the United States for 30 years. But I went to visit my sister in Vichy and asked if they had a Christian bookstore there. The answer was no, there are not enough Christians here to sustain a Christian bookstore. So the question becomes, are we now at a point where we can't sustain our own Christianity? Another thing is, we used to view life as this is the Christians against the big bad world, but now the big fights are happening for the core of the denomination. You've got Methodists and Presbyterians who are thinking homosexual is fine, behavior that would have been reprehensible decades ago now is in the pulpit. And no wonder people are confused when somebody, John Q. Average, wakes up and says, I want to go to a Christian church. It's a coin flip what kind of Christian church they're even going to find, if they'll find a Christian church that still preaches the gospel. So what are your thoughts on that?
Wow. Your question is really pretty comprehensive in a lot of pieces. I'll try to touch on many of them. The first comment, especially concerning the fact that people are not reading as much as they were, does that inform us in any way as to what's happening in Christianity? And I think it is. I think there's a direct relationship to the way that Christians uphold truth. Unfortunately, I think in our day, truth is moving from a rational basis to more of an experiential basis. And so now what's true for me may not necessarily be true for you. And so we're not running to the bookstore to read about absolute truth because we're not accepting truth. And so why read what has been written in an objective, absolute kind of way? And so henceforth, you know, people are not reading so much. I think that answers a part of what you've got, of what you mentioned. I think the other thing is, our society is changing in terms of how we are relating to one another. Technology and the internet have made wonderful advances, and they are powerful and wonderful tools. Unfortunately, those same tools can also be channels for negative and destructive behaviors. And unfortunately, I think evil in the world has overtaken those tools, and the church has not, you know, really utilized them, I would say. And secondly, the church is not helping people to understand how to think in this world where the basis for our thought has changed so dramatically.
Well, tell me about the Christian and Missionary Alliance denomination. My husband and I were married in a Christian and Missionary Alliance church out in Massachusetts. Sadly, that church is no more. Not only was it dissolved, but the whole building was torn down and they made it into a subdivision. And it's a painful reminder of the secularization of our society, that even my own church I was married in is dust. And then I went to Nyack College in Nyack, New York, and that was a special time, but the announcement came out a few weeks ago that they're moving everything to New York City now. And I'm looking, even there was an Alliance church here in the St. Louis area, Crestwood Alliance, very special memories. The first time I ever went there was on a Good Friday service, and it was the closest thing I've ever experienced to the Old Testament reference of the temple being filled with smoke. It was so glorious. You could feel the presence of the Holy Spirit in there. It was when the spade leaders were there, and there were a lot of there was a lot of fervor. The people were on fire for God. And yet even that church is no more. How are we supposed to interpret these events in a way that makes sense? If God is still the same yesterday and tomorrow, why is the church faltering?
Yeah, well, first of all, the Christian Missionary Alliance is a wonderful movement. The distinctives of the alliance that focus on the beauty of Jesus as our Savior and Messiah, and then also how he is the Lord. He's also the coming King. So the Christian Missionary Alliance has a rich history, having started as a missions movement, and in fact, started out there in New York City with A.B. Simpson, who led a bunch of dock workers to Christ and was helping them to grow. And out of that movement started the Christian Missionary Alliance. Unfortunately, the Christian Missionary Alliance is not unlike many denominations today that are really in a fight for their survival. Unfortunately, the programs turned into an organization, and the organization turned into an institution. And so many resources and so much activity and behavior and work is being poured into sustaining the organization as opposed to the organism, the life of Christ and the energy and dynamic of the gospel. So many resources are being put into just sustaining the organizational, the logistics and all. And the CMA is not alone in that. As you mentioned earlier, many other denominations are fighting for their existence. Unfortunately, they are allowing many of the cultural dynamics to change their stance on many key positions. And I remember when I went through my doctoral degree, there was a significant focus on exactly that, how major denominations are handling the gay issues, how they are handling homosexual issues, how they are looking at divorce and marriage. And it's, you know, the denominations, unfortunately, are becoming fractured. Plus, one last thing. Because of cynicism, people's cynicism is growing as a result of what's happening in our society in terms of government. That's also true in terms of denominations. People are not valuing organizations anymore, and so they're becoming skeptical of denominations. They walk into a building that belongs to some denomination where the headquarters is in Montana or Nevada or Missouri, and they wonder, how does that relate to me? And so they're no longer placing a great deal of value on the denomination. As a result, churches are struggling for their identity. Who are we?
You were 48 years old when you felt like it's time to become a missionary. Give us some advice. For those listening, there are a lot of people who want to make a difference in the world, and we don't know what we're supposed to do now. And the scariest part is looking at our own mortality and realizing that maybe we've done nothing to move the dial. What is the purpose of our lives? And match this up for us with your own experience of how did you know when it was time to get out of the box and go overseas and do something dramatically different?
Well, that's a great question, and I'll give you a short answer and then I'll unpack it. The reality is, I didn't know. The only thing I knew, and Marion and I went through this together, we knew that God was doing something different and that he was calling us to go overseas. We knew that. If we had time, I could unpack that. It was interesting how that in six or seven miraculous events over the period of 7 months, where there was absolutely no chance for circumstances to be in control. It was clearly God's work. We knew that he wanted us to go. Gladly, we were faithful enough to obey. And it wasn't until after we went that we began to understand why he wanted us to go. And he wanted us to go, Cynthia, so that we would open our eyes. My eyes were opened so wide. And I would say this. Before I went overseas, I was an American Christian. When I went overseas, I realized how American my Christianity was, and not necessarily how kingdom my Christianity was. And so that opportunity opened my eyes to the cultural dynamics, the distinctives of culture, and what was going on in the world, and looking at that whole picture, not only through one window, like, for instance, the Christian Missionary Alliance window. As a result of that, God began to speak to me about exactly what you were saying, making a difference in the world. And I began to look at how did Jesus make a difference in the world? He came, we know, in the flesh to die on the cross. We get that. We understand that as believers, as people who profess to follow Christ. But why did God give us a 3-year story of his public ministry? Why did he give us so many details about how he interacted with a few people? Yes, he spoke to masses on occasion, but for the most part, poured his life into a few people. Quite frankly, if we look at that picture through modern eyes, especially if we look through it through Western modern eyes, we might say Jesus was not very wise. He didn't rent a Colosseum. He didn't put on large crusades and get as many people as possible. Quite frankly, he must have wasted his time simply talking to a few people, hanging out with 12 and really more than any others, a lot of time with three guys called the inner circle. And the more I began to look at that, the more I realized if we want to change the world, if we want to make a difference in our whole neighborhood, in our state, in our country, then we have to start with a few people and pour our lives into them so that they too can do the same thing. That message from the Gospels began to really pour into my own life, and the result is that I changed my ministry, I changed my focus, and as well as I can, I try to do the same thing that Jesus did, pouring my life into a few people at a time, helping them to multiply.
So what is the difference between your typical American Christian and a Christian who sees the entire world?
Well, I think looking at the world like Jesus looked at the world, first of all, he looked at the world and it broke his heart to see the expanse of sinfulness and how that it had fallen from the perfection, the wonderful thing that the Father created originally. And he didn't dwell on the negative, though, because he's thinking right away, how can we spread this redemption? And of course, we know that he came and died on the cross. And we have this opportunity of looking at the world and not being overcome by the sinfulness of the world, but instead saying, okay, let's look at this just the same way that Jesus did. And let's prayerfully and seriously find a few people and develop strong relationships with those few people and help them to, help them to get it, just like I'm getting it, and help them to do the same thing. By doing so, if we look back at church history, Jesus actually started a multiplicational discipleship movement. Yes, there was church planting, but the church planting was only able to be accomplished based on the foundation of discipleship. When Paul went on his missionary journeys, the first thing he did was to find a few people that were the people that God wanted him to influence and disciple. And he did that. And so, Cynthia, I think in the church today, my heart really cries out for the church to take a look at what it's doing. And instead of embracing large programs and mass production techniques, really business techniques, and instead take a fresh look at how Christ made disciples and seriously consider how can we adopt and adapt his methodologies to our situation to make disciples.
Well, give me an example then, because I'm not seeing it. I see a lot of churches who do programs, but they're not addressing the deepest need. You feel like you put your money in the offering plate and watch the show. And nothing wrong with that if that's what floats your boat. But why even do we have church planting anymore in America if that's the way it's going to be?
Well, you've said a mouthful there, Cynthia, but the good news is that it is possible to make disciples and see those people pulled together into a community, whether large or small, and when they begin to function as a body, we see the church develop. The bottom line is this, Cynthia. Jesus said, go make disciples. We know that that's the command he gave to people that were following him. So from his day onward, the command is to you and I to make disciples. And if we keep that in mind and yet look at what he said about the church, in Matthew, he told Peter, I will build the church. Cynthia, you and I, our job is to make disciples. Jesus will build the church. My dad was a builder, and he built a lot of homes, and he was such a craftsman. And I think about the illustration. I remember when he would lay the foundation for a house, and he would take block by block with the cement. Cynthia, that's how you build a church. Jesus is waiting for us to make disciples. He's basically saying, I'll build the church, but I need the building blocks to build it with. And the building blocks are disciples. And you can't skip that. You can't just replace discipleship with an entertainment program with light show and sound equipment and music and expect that to somehow overcome the deficiency of the foundation, which is discipleship. And I see, for instance, I would like to give you a practical example in Kazakhstan. Some years ago, I worked for 3 years in Kazakhstan on a particular project. A ministry asked me to come, and they said, David, we want you to help our church planters to understand how to make disciples. And there were about 60 or 70 of them. And I told them, I said, I can't possibly do that. They said, no problem. We can have a conference. We'll pull everybody together. We'll pay for their travel expenses. And I said, yes, I know. That's the problem. I said, you see, I could not possibly pour my life into that many people. I could pour my life into a half a dozen, maybe even 10 or 12, possibly. they let me set the standard so high that we ended up with about 12 or 13. And then after we got started, about 8 or 10 continued. And for 3 years, Cynthia, I made trips from Budapest to Kazakhstan, 6 or 7 trips a year, 2 to 3 weeks each trip. And we didn't go to a conference center. I went to their homes and slept on the floor often because they don't have large homes like we do. And I invested my life into those people. And I don't want to draw attention to myself, but what I want to draw attention to is the process. It was a life-on-life discipleship process. And Cynthia, after just 7 or 8 months, we would get together and talk about what God is doing in our lives. And instead of talking about grandiose visions and big things we want to accomplish, we saw men with tears coming down their cheeks talking about how God was changing their hearts, how he was helping them to understand biblical humility, and how he was helping them to be sensitive to their wives, sensitive to their children, sensitive to other people, and how that they, when they presented the good news, the attitude with which they did that was a godly attitude. And churches were planted that grew, but they didn't grow fast, but they grew deep. And they are still being sustained today by those same leaders. So discipleship, it's just good old life-on-life ministry, is the bedrock in order to overcome the cultural shifts that are pressing in on us and are challenging us and make us very uncomfortable.
Okay, so you just got back from Eastern Europe a week or two ago. And what did you see there? And what are we supposed to do here in America? I mean, given that we've got a different dynamic, do they have something on us?
Well, it's not what they have on us. It's what they don't have. One of the things I see, Cynthia, whenever I go over, like, for instance, I've got a significant program in Ukraine, and not necessarily in Kyiv, which is the capital city, but when you go out of the capital city, life becomes a lot more simple than the life we have here in the U.S. I suppose a comparison could be made between a lifestyle in New York City or in Los Angeles and what you might find, for instance, 100 or 200 miles west of you in mid-Missouri out in the country where life slows down and is more simple. The reality is, I think that because of technology and because of transportation, there are a lot more alternatives that people end up accessing and taking advantage of. Whereas in Ukraine, for instance, or in many other countries in Eastern Europe, for that matter, there's more people go to what's happening in the faith arena. And especially in Ukraine nowadays, where there's a military action on their southern border. Putin is threatening, and I'm sure that you have read about that in the news. So people understand their country is at war, and even some of their husbands and sons are being killed on the front lines. That happens daily. There are Ukrainian soldiers being killed. And in a small country like that, even though the numbers being killed are small, it really impacts society. So those pressures, I think, are causing people to be more sensitive to life and death issues, more sensitive to what is God doing in our country? What does he want to do in my life? Where can I find hope? Where can I find peace? Where can I find safety? People are looking to those kind of issues, where, as in our country, we're more worried about the Super Bowl game or what's going on, at the theater. And so, I think that in our country, there's a lot of alternatives. and people are not serious about serious issues.
So what's the craziest thing you've seen over there that would shock us in America?
In Eastern Europe, and this is also true in Asia, not only Eastern Europe, but in Eastern Europe, the people there really value someone who is older and who can talk about failure and as well as success. In this country, quite frank, I will be 70 years old in a couple of months, and I am not invited a lot to talk about discipleship in churches. And when I am, it goes okay. But in Eastern Europe, Cynthia, I could be over there every month and busy, busy, busy. And when I go into a conference, I can tell you this, I don't get a break. In a 3-day conference, usually there's like 1-hour segments and you get a 10 minute break in between segments or 15 minutes. I don't get 10 or 15 minutes. At the end of the hour, everybody lines up and they're asking me questions. I can't get a break. They want to hear from somebody who's been there, who's done that, and who is willing to talk about what happened when you failed. What happened when what you did just horribly was a disaster? What did you do then? How did the people react? How did you react? And so the young people, and I'm talking about young people in Ukraine, are a lot more attentive.
So comparing us to what you're seeing over there, it sounds like they've got a lot more interest in spiritual things. Here we are in America. We're trying to make disciples, but there aren't a whole lot of people who want to be made into disciples. Not everybody can go to Ohio. What is your advice for things we can do right here in our own community to make disciples? What does that mean we're supposed to do?
Right. Well, because of technology and internet, a lot of resources are available to us, and so there are good resources. What I would recommend, Cynthia, is this. Take a fresh look at Matthew 28 and the Great Commission, for instance, and simply read it, the words where Jesus said, go make disciples, and realize that he wasn't speaking to the church. He was speaking to people. And so I would encourage people that might listen to your podcast, allow God to ask you, how is it that you are making disciples? A question I use, Cynthia, many times when people say, well, when you talk about discipleship, what do you mean that might be different than what we're talking about, or the fact that we already are making disciples? What could you possibly tell us? I ask them this question. I say, I understand what you're saying. Could you answer this for me? Could you give me the name of your spiritual great, great grandchild? And they look at me and say, what are you talking about? And I say, well, Jesus said, go make disciples, and disciples are people. And I'm assuming that the disciples you're making have names. So just give me the name of one, not 4 or 5 or 10, but just one disciple that is your spiritual great, great grandchild. And then they begin to think and realize, oh my, I have been a Christian for 20 years or 30 years or 40 years. I think I've made some influence in some people's lives, but could I pull the name of one person back in 1972 when I met him, and I invested my life into him for a couple of years or whatever, and he went on to make another disciple, and that disciple went on to make another disciple, and now I can tell you about young Joe, who's 21 years old, and he is my great, great, great grandchild in the Lord.
What an interesting concept. So you were 48 when you felt like God was calling you to do something different. You're almost 70. What's on the next? What's next on the horizon? Do people ever get too old? Are we supposed to hang it up at some point?
Cynthia, I've had so many wonderful opportunities in the ministry. I've spoke at some rather large churches overseas, and so I've had that experience. I've pastored a couple of churches in the U.S., good experiences. I've been a missionary for the Christian Missionary Alliance for 8 years over in Eastern Europe, a good experience. Still now a missionary, going back and forth over to Eastern Europe quite often. What's next? Next is what happens when I breathe my last here in the flesh. Until then, I want to continue. I don't ever think about retirement, really. I'm not sure that retirement is a biblical concept. I like to tell people this. I want to continue to make disciples, and I would like to continue to do a lot of disciple work and leadership development overseas as long as I'm still able to have fun doing it. And I do have fun. The travel is becoming harder, but the actual ministry is still fun. What do I want to do? May I tell you this? The most wonderful things in my life have just happened in the last 4 to 5 years. Until about 4 or 5 years ago, if someone would have asked me, David, give me the name of one of your spiritual great, great, great grandchildren, fourth generation, okay? Fourth generation grandchild. I couldn't have done it. But Cynthia, now I could give you the names of 7 or 8 fourth generation spiritual grandchildren. There is nothing, I tell you, Cynthia, there is nothing so fulfilling, so encouraging than that. To think that I know that there are men who are making disciples, who are making disciples, who are making disciples, who are making disciples that are producing those kind of grandchildren. As long as God gives me the strength, the mental acuity and the physical ability to keep the travel up and keep the rigors of that ministry up, I want to continue to be fulfilled by hearing about more spiritual grandchildren.
Sounds like a great plan. Give us some marching orders. What do we do, number one, if we want to be like you? If we want to go out there and make disciples, because that's really the only thing that's why do we still live on the planet? Are we here to go watch movies and eat popcorn, or are we supposed to actually do something? So if we take that commandment seriously to make disciples, what is the path to doing that?
Okay. Well, let me just tell you two things, okay? The first thing I want to tell you is I want to tell you in very short order, Jesus's philosophy of ministry. Cynthia, how long have you been a Christian?
Decades.
Let me ask you a question. I know you're interviewing me, but allow me to use this as an illustration. How many times has anyone ever offered to you Jesus's philosophy of ministry?
Not too often. I think you're the first.
Cynthia, can you think of almost anything that's more important than to understand how did Jesus think about ministry?
No, nothing more important.
I mean, it's just mind-boggling that we don't hear about it all the time. To make a long story short, it's this. Jesus came to seek and to save the whole world. Jesus was a big thinker. Jesus thought big. But he started small. he congregated just a few people around him and invested a lot of time in just a few people. And he did that because he wanted to take a few people very deep into his heart. And that was his philosophy of ministry. Think big, start small, so that he could go deep. In response to your question, what do we do? Think big. Allow the burden, the challenge of what's going on in the world to be before us so that we can realize, wow, look at this challenge. It's huge. And we need to understand that it really is big. And when we do that, we understand there's no way that I can change it myself. There's no way. So what do I do? Well, pray and ask God to give you a couple people. Start small. Start getting together with them and help them to see, what did Jesus do? How did he think? How did he interact with people? Dive into the Gospels like never before. See what he did and how he lived his life. Figure out how we can do the same thing in our lives and help those people to go very deep into the same kind of relationship that Jesus had with the Father. His relationship with the Father was so close, he even said this, I can do nothing but what the Father shows me. Wow. I ask myself, Cynthia, sometimes when I find myself doing something, I ask myself, did the Father show me to do this, or is this something I decided to do on my own? That gives us an understanding of the depth of relationship that Jesus had with the Father. And he helped his disciples to get into that same kind of relationship. So what do we do? Think big, start small, get a few people, go deep, take action, take the initiative. Let me ask you another question rhetorically. How many disciples ran after Jesus and asked him, can we follow you? Not one. Isn't it interesting? In every case, Jesus took the initiative. That means, Cynthia, you and I, and other people that call ourselves believers, we've got to take the initiative. We have got to prayerfully say, okay, God, who do you want us to get together with, and find some people, and then say, you know what, I'm trying to be a better follower of Jesus. Would you like to get together with me on a regular basis? And let's talk about it and look at his life and figure out how we can make our lives reflect his life. And of course, that means we're going to be looking at the Bible a lot. It means we're going to be praying. It means we're going to be spending a whole lot of time together. And it means that we'll probably watch less TV and we'll do less entertainment stuff. And we'll be focusing on what it means to be a disciple maker. And slowly but surely, we'll change the world.
That sounds like a plan. Slowly but surely, we'll change the world. We'll let God change it through us. Because I'll tell you right now, it's on a bad trajectory. It doesn't take much observation to see that it's going down, at least here. Do you see any spots in the whole world where things are going up, where things are getting better, where people actually are getting discipled and it's making a difference in their politics and in their culture?
Well, Cynthia, that's kind of a tricky question, because if we look at the world through biblical eyes, we know that ultimately things are not going to be in good shape. In fact, they're going to be in such horrible shape that the sun is going to come back and redeem us out of it. Okay, so we know that at some point in time that's going to happen. At the same time, yes, there are places in the world where the gospel is taking root, where there is spiritual movement and spiritual growth. I see that happening some in Ukraine. It's still happening to a great extent in Romania. But then, and this is not my particular focus field, but in Latin America, there is a tremendous growth of the gospel. where so many people are coming to Christ, that really the problem is not finding people who are interested in the gospel, but finding people and resources who are willing to help these new believers to get grounded and get started. We desperately need people who are able to make disciples. And so I do see that in Latin America. Now, also one other place, and I know this is going to sound somewhat redundant. You perhaps have had other speakers talk about China. The reality is, Cynthia, I just came back last year in the first week in November. I was in a seminar in Kenya with MentorLink organization, which I represent. And we were talking about some of the work in China. And Cynthia, the churches are spreading like wildfire in China. But of course, it's all underground. The churches are not registered with the government. They are house churches. And on that note, let me say, Cynthia, earlier in the interview, I mentioned that denominations are having a tough time. And churches are having trouble finding their own identity apart from denominations. At the same time, there is a movement we don't hear much about. It's called the house church movement. And we don't hear about it because the normal way that we have of documenting what's going on in our country on the religious scene is by doing research. We open up the Yellow Pages and we look for churches that are on the Yellow Pages. But house churches aren't on the Yellow Pages. So we need a different radar unit, as it were, to find out where are these blips on the radar screen that are called house churches. Well, that's pretty tough to do, but I can tell you anecdotally that many people who, for whatever reason, are disparaged by what's happening in the traditional church, many people, not all, but many of them are becoming involved in house churches. I myself am in a house church. Marion and I could not be happier to be exactly where we are in a house church. One exciting benefit of that is that Marion and I, though we are living on missionary support and Social Security, we're actually able to help a couple of other missionaries overseas to do ministry. And the reason we're able to do that is because we're not fixing roofs. We're not fixing sidewalks or parking lots. We're not purchasing copier machines for the church office or sound mechanisms. We're actually supporting missionaries who are doing ministry. So there is something happening in the world, and it is happening in our country, and it's called house church.
What a great idea. So what does somebody do if they're looking to plug in somewhere like that and we can't find it? It's not in the Yellow Pages and we're floundering.
Yeah. Yeah, if we can't find it, I would encourage somebody to do some Googling, because there are some house church networks. We do belong to a house church network. In fact, I have been mentoring the leader of the house church network that we belong to. It's a network of house churches throughout Kentucky, and we're in Ohio, and there's something like 70 or 80 house churches that have been started. There are other networks across the country as well, and they can be found online. If there's not one close, you can still read about it. There are resources. There are people that will help. And house church is not rocket science. You can start a house church tonight. And so you can read about it and how to do that without going into that right now. But it is possible, even if there is not one to join, you can start one, get some friends who want to come together, and there are resources to help you to do that.
Okay, and if people would like to support your ministry, what are we supposed to do?
Well, they could send me an email. I think it'd be the best way right now. I don't have all the contact information, but we do have an organization. It's called Joy to the World. and they take care of all of our IRS stuff so that we're perfectly legal and on the up and up, and there's receipts, and the government is happy with the way that we handle our finances. And so we do have an organization to do that. But if somebody is interested in being a part, they could send an email to me, davidatoth@me.com, and I would give them the information.
What a great idea. Give us one last parting piece of advice. What do you want to say? There are a lot of people in many different states who are hungry for what you're doing. What would you advise us to do?
That's a great question. I think I would advise people to take a fresh look at the gospel and understand that it is the doorway to the kingdom. When Jesus started his public ministry, he said, "Behold, the kingdom of God is at hand." And then he proceeded to talk to people about grace and forgiveness and repentance, those items that we have come to know as the gospel. But I would encourage believers across the country, as wonderful as the gospel is, even though the gospel is the only way to God and into the kingdom, don't get stuck in the door. Go all the way in to the through the doorway of the gospel into the kingdom. Let's begin living kingdom lives now. This is the time to prepare for living an eternal kingdom life. So let's not get stuck in the door of the gospel. Let's realize that the gospel is the doorway into the kingdom. So much of what Jesus said was to help us to be better kingdom citizens. He never once helped anybody to try to be a better Roman citizen or a better Hebrew citizen. He was all about the kingdom. We need to be all about the kingdom.
All right. Well, that sounds like a great plan. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. This has been very enriching.
Been fun, Cynthia. Thank you.
This has been another edition of Homefront. I'm Cynthia Davis, and I thank you for joining us. We're taking America back one family at a time. I sincerely hope you heard something that left you feeling inspired, motivated, and ready to engage our culture. If you enjoyed our show, you can find more at cynthiadavis.net. You can also find me on Facebook at Homefront with Cynthia Davis. Have a great week, and make sure you come back next time for another edition of Homefront.